طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly 45-minute segment of news from Palestine and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal military occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program presents news and analysis from the Palestinian perspective, a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. We ask our listeners, as we do every week, were you involved last week in the Palestinian-Israel peace movement and the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's savage military attacks against them to force them out of their homes and annex their properties into Israel? Did you speak out on the atrocities Israel is committing every day in Gaza and the West Bank? If not, why not? What is your reason not to? We cannot overemphasize to our listeners that the best thing you can do is to go to Palestine and experience the situation on the ground for yourselves. There is nothing that can bring home to you the realities on the ground in Palestine than to go there and see for yourselves. Never mind what you hear out of the filter of the mainstream media, or for that matter, what you may hear in this program. The best way to discover the truth is to go and see for yourselves. Nothing that you may have read or heard could prepare you for what you will see.
And now, this is Stan Robinson breaking in at this point, and the reason for this is we actually do not have Sharif here with us this week. He is taking a extremely well-deserved week off, and accordingly, I am making an attempt to shoulder the responsibility for the main bulk of this week in Palestine. I will do so in two parts. The first one is by bringing about a half an hour segment of Talk Nation Radio in which Ridgely Fuller, who is a local peace activist who's been to Gaza with Code Pink, and then the second half is going to be a live interview with some people, Ray Davies and Wendy Lewis, whom you are about to meet, and I think you will find that extremely worthwhile. So here comes Talk Nation Radio. Fasten your seatbelts.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. We're joined by Ridgely Fuller, a social worker and peace activist with Code Pink. She's been to Israel and Palestine during trips in 2002, 2003, and 2009, and she most recently visited Gaza. Ridgely Fuller is touring the East Coast with a slideshow on Palestine. She will visit Connecticut September 14th to speak at the First Church of Christ in Mansfield. It's at 7 p.m. at 549 Storrs Road. Local residents call for information 429-3107. Ridgely Fuller, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you start by talking about your reasons for doing this kind of educational project?
Most of the talks I've done has either been in Maine or small groups in Massachusetts. And I think part of what people are really hungry for is for real information. You know, Israel doesn't allow a lot of media in, and because our mainstream media doesn't report on what's really going on in Palestine, both the West Bank and Gaza. So I think people who are peace activists are really hungry for information. For that kind of population, I really hope to encourage the kind of activism that's so important.
Now, like many other members of Code Pink, you also visit Congress, right?
Right. What I'm most interested in is in talking to groups of people who are not necessarily already totally committed to the Palestinian issue. I feel like, you know, I've just been reading John Lewis's autobiography, The Civil Rights Leader, who talked about the importance of broadening people's mind, not necessarily being able to change them, but at least broaden them. And I think that's what I really try and do. And with that in mind, I have been, within the last month, I've been to Susan Collins' office up in Maine. And I don't know if you're aware, but she is a very strong supporter of the current Israel policy. So going into her office was very interesting talking to one of their aides. I've been to Senator Kerry's office and talked with the aides there. I'm actually going to Congressman Delahunt's office on Thursday.
Bill Delahunt, the 10th District of Massachusetts.
We've been trying to get an appointment with my Congressman Ed Markey since January, and this has been a consistent effort on our part where we've been making daily phone calls, we've had vigils, we've had small and large groups going in requests, we've had petitions throughout his district, just to ask to have a meeting with him. First it was to talk about Gaza and the war and the siege on Gaza. And those phone calls, none of them have been even answered. It's just an absolute amazing situation. 2 weeks ago, I went to an event where he spoke at a temple in Lexington, and I actually approached him, and I told him that there was a group of us who had been trying to meet with him since January, and he said he would be very willing to meet with us. I talked to his aide and said, "You've heard this on the record," and aide said, "Yes. I've been to his office, I made phone calls, and still they don't respond." So this is like an exercise in democracy at this point, you know. But I think there are a lot of congressmen that just don't get a lot of information. 5 years ago, when I came back from the West Bank, Barney Frank was my congressman, and he met with me alone. He gave me probably 40 minutes of his time to look at the slides I had of the West Bank, and the wall was just being built at that point. And I asked him where he got his information from about Israel and the Palestinian issue, and he talked about it was really mainstream media, and we know that mainstream media is not covering this issue at all. So, again, whether it's congressional offices or audiences that don't maybe have a lot of information, part of what I really try to do is broaden their kind of experience. And I think about the apartheid movement in South Africa, and I think that boycott, divestment, and sanctions is so important. But as far as my knowledge is that once Congress ended up voting to support the sanctions, that's when the president of South Africa at that point started meeting with Mandela. So even though a lot of people think that I'm batting my head against the wall, in fact, I renamed myself as Patsy Fuller because I'm the Patsy for thinking that Ed Markey's office is going to respond to me in as a respectful way as that I have maintained in his office. I feel like that's a really important thing to do. So one of the things I'm hoping to do in the fall is to get a lot of information about the effect of U.S. weapons in Gaza and to make a 10-minute presentation out of that and go to the congressional offices in Washington.
The Bush administration, of course, negotiated a 10-year agreement to provide $30 billion in military aid to Israel, and that aid rained down as of February 2009 in the form of 500-pound bombs and Hellfire missiles and white phosphorus artillery shells. Why don't you talk about the significance of the impact of U.S. weapons on the people of Palestine?
In Gaza, one of the things that I learned about was this new piece of military equipment called DIME, and it's an explosive rocket that releases tiny, tiny little pellets, and it's radioactive. The Norwegian doctors there had never seen anything like it. This is such a new weapon that the world community has not been able to outlaw it yet, like white phosphorus. This new DIME rocket, which they say is going to become so popular because it's only 6 feet long, it doesn't weigh a whole lot, but it causes incredible organ damage. It also does a lot of huge, serious amputations, and it also, for people who are able to survive it, and this is according to U.S. military information, the rate of cancer is 99% in the testing they did on rats. There's titanium in it, and the U.S. government sold Israel 1,000 of these weapons in September. Many of them were used. I really believe that the Palestinians, and I'm not the only person to believe this, are used as experimental kind of laboratories for weapons. And I actually believe that the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition is going to be writing a book about this fall. And it has to do with heavily, densely populated areas. Armies are trying to learn how to control these areas. And in some ways, Gaza, I think, is used as a laboratory. So you have the DIME stuff, you have white phosphorus, you have F-16s that are so prevalent, being used all the time, Apache helicopters shooting rockets. I have pictures of, there's a Samuni family that was even featured in Newsweek, that mainstream media, when they start talking about these things, you know that it's a big deal. And they lost 26 members of their own family. The Israelis came in, put 100, I think, of the Sunni families in one home, and then that was shelled by Apache rockets. So it was flattened on top of them, and 26 people were killed. I went and spent a day visiting that family, and they have, you know, I have pictures of them with the rocket shells that are clearly U.S.-made. Now, it's against U.S. law for weapons that we export to be used in an aggressive way. They're only supposed to be able to be used for defensive purposes. So it's clearly illegal. Amnesty International, I believe, is talking about, you know, we should stop military aid. We should certainly stop it until Israel and the international community has been willing to make a really impartial assessment of how these weapons have been used.
Just give us a sense now of both the damage from Israeli bombing this past winter and also the increase in military pressure still coming from Israel.
One of the doctors that I met talked about how the people in Gaza are in a prison. You know, nobody's really allowed in. No one's allowed out. But despite being in a prison, now they're not even allowed to live in peace within that prison. The coast is constantly being shelled by the Israeli Navy. International law and the Oslo Agreement said that the Palestinians would have 20 miles of fishing rights. Well, that's been reduced to 3 miles, and that's a unilateral decision by Israel, who shell any boat that approaches the 3 mile limit. And even within that limit, boats are being harassed a lot, and fishermen are being abducted and kidnapped. And this is even documented by the Israeli press, so this is nothing new. And then if you go on the east side, where is the big agricultural zone, which is actually probably, I think they said 60% of the best land, of agricultural land for farmland, is that Israel has unilaterally prevented farmers from using that land. Initially, there was this buffer zone that was maybe 200 meters, and now since, actually, during the ceasefire, Israel increased that to 350 meters, and I've just read reports now that farmers are being shot within 500 meters of the border. So the land that they're able to use is really being squished. And you talk about 1.5 million people in a very, very small area. You know, and similarly, the whole northern area, and they talk about 1.5 kilometers, was totally destroyed. Everything there, the houses, that's where a lot of the industrial sector was, that's all been flattened. And I think Senator Kerry was there in the spring. Other Congress people have been there to visit and have really been, according to my, when I've talked to the UN there, they have been appalled by the amount of destruction there. So I think it's important for people to be able to see the conditions under which the Palestinians in Gaza are now being forced to live. And I think in terms of the density, it's 2/3 of the people who live in Gaza are actually refugees from Palestine of 1948 when Israel was made a state, and there were so many refugees, there were people who were forced to flee. So they're still living in refugee camps in Gaza, and Jabalia up in the north, the density there is 75,000 per square kilometer. New York City, it's 25,000 per square kilometer, and the settlements in the Western Bank, which Netanyahu, they want to keep expanding, is only 625 people per square kilometer. So I think it gives you a sense of the relativity of the way people are living.
Just say more about the still relatively new but right-wing government of Benjamin Netanyahu. Were you surprised to see someone like him come to power in Israel again with his even more extreme foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman?
I think there are many of us in our trips to Palestine or meeting with lots of Palestinians are very concerned that Israel wants the resources and the land of the Palestinians but is not particularly interested in making peace. I think there's a lot of evidence for that concern. So in some ways, the government in Israel doesn't surprise me. I think I felt like what was very disappointing was that 80% apparently of the Israelis felt that the war on Gaza should be continued, and they were supportive of it, despite the fact that the Israeli Defense Department on their website was showing that during the ceasefire, rockets were not being flown into Israel from Gaza. There was a statement showing a graph showing the decrease in rockets that were being sent over into Israel, and there was an acknowledgement that some of those rockets that did make it over there during the ceasefire were by other groups in Gaza who were determined to make Hamas look bad. So this is all part of the Israeli, you know, military stand, So there was no justification, no self-defense justification for what Israel did in terms of unleashing the invasion on Gaza. It was an aggressive act. There was nothing defensive about it. If they had wanted to continue the ceasefire, that's what they needed to do, was continue the ceasefire. The Hamas government offered twice to continue it. The Egyptian government and the Israeli government both agree with that. Hamas offered to extend the ceasefire despite Israel having broken it on November 4th when they did an incursion into Gaza and killed six Palestinians that they said were building a tunnel into Israel. And if, in fact, that was true, then why didn't they just wait in the Israeli side of the tunnel for them to come out? But they did an incursion, and the ceasefire was broken. So Israel's totally responsible for that. The New York Times and The Guardian and Reuters have all commented that Israel is the one that broke the ceasefire. So I think there are a lot of misconceptions that are flying around.
Now, you've mentioned that there are some parts for new hospital equipment that Israel won't allow into Gaza, but could be really helpful to people there.
So the center in the main hospital that was given by an Arab country, and it's this whole new center, and the doctors who work there describe it as a place that's a body with no soul, because you go in there and everything is new and it's never been used because the MRI equipment lacks a certain kind of isotope that Israel won't allow in. And that's certainly for the cancer center. So that's part of my presentation of these slides of this new equipment that is just sitting there really waiting to be used. And it's all set up, and there's probably about 5,000 people who were wounded during the invasion, and they're talking about 1,700 who are permanently handicapped. So they're either amputees or they have spinal cord or some kind of neurological damage that is really going to totally not just impact their life, but also impact the lives of their families, who will end up spending so much time and resources taking care of these people. As I said, the 1,700 of those, of the wounded, are in this very severe category. And if the hospital that does the rehabilitation was heavily hit, so that many, many rooms they're not able to use. And when we were there in June, it still was in the same condition. As you probably know, people who are needing this kind of rehabilitation and even really good prosthetics are not allowed out of the country. So they have a very hard time getting through Egypt. And if they go through Israel, if they're allowed out, and even the Israeli physicians for human rights have documented that any patients who are coming to Israel at the border, they're required to agree to become collaborators once they go back to Palestine. So there are a number of people who have refused any kind of a medical treatment in Israel. We met several amputees and also a boy who had burns from white phosphorus. Males who are 15 and over are not allowed out of Gaza at all. Women who, I think you can be, as I remember, up to 16 or 17, you can get out for medical treatment. So this is clearly, they're very concerned about having young men being rehabilitated or leaving on the outside. I did run into a 14-year-old who was going to end up going to Seattle to have a prosthesis made, and I was actually trying to help kind of develop some arrangement help with some support system once he got into the Seattle hospital. But I haven't been able to make contact with the people in Gaza again to make sure that's arranged.
But it sounds like some of what you experienced when you were in Gaza also holds promise as an opportunity for Americans to link up in some way with Palestinians and maybe get something done in spite of some of the blockades to that.
Code Pink was invited by the United Nations, and John Ging is head of UNRWA, which is the United Nations, the organization that worked with refugees. And he talked about the importance of citizen diplomacy when he met us. And he was feeling like that's what we were doing, is citizen diplomacy. And Viva Palestina and the Gaza boats, it's all citizen diplomacy, kind of trying to do what governments have not been able to or not been willing to do. I mean, I always felt like when I was there, especially I met with some professors, and that they were very hungry for international access because it's so denied. But most of it's symbolic, and part of what we do is we help humanize what is often considered the enemy by our mainstream media or whoever is defining the world framework at the time. And I think our efforts really are humanizing. I mean, when I went to meet with these professors, and it was kind of accidental, and it was a very interesting meeting, it was a gathering kind of in their association house where they'd go and chat with each other, kind of get support, and they'd meet once a week. And so I was going to take their picture, and they said, no, we want you to take it in the next room. So I went to the next room, and they were all laughing because there was a huge hole in the ceiling where a rocket had come through. So it shows, I think, their sense of humor, their resiliency, and those are human qualities that hopefully we all have, and that we're able to connect with each other because we realize how much more we have in common. In northern Gaza on the seacoast, they were trying to build a resort on the Mediterranean. And again, that was another structure that the Israelis closed down. So you have this very bizarre sense of time stopping in a lot of different areas. But you had a lot of internal joy because the Israelis and the settlers were no longer there. Emotionally, I think people felt freer. There wasn't this incredible fear, even though the war had been, or it wasn't even a war because the Palestinians were in no position to defend themselves, but the invasion had happened. But there wasn't that incredible fear, so there was a lot of a freer sense emotionally among the Palestinians.
When you were there, were people more hopeful, you know, having just learned that the White House would now be occupied by a new person, Barack Obama, who has spoken about peace?
Barack Obama actually ended up in Cairo while we were still in Gaza, and I think there was a lot of hope, and that's really true. But I think there's this pervasive sense that the foreign policy of the United States government has not changed, and it's still so supportive of Israel, so that policies like the invasion and the siege and our providing enormous amount of military weapons, all of that is still in place. I didn't really have a sense that they were more hopeful about the American government particularly. I think there was a wait-and-see attitude.
You've had a unique experience in meeting women in particular, but, you know, people from both Israel and Palestine. What has that shown you?
The last time I was in Israel was in 2003 when I was part of this International Women's Human Rights March, and it was a three-week march. It was organized by Israeli and Palestinian women who had never actually been able to meet face-to-face. So it was fascinating because when we were marching through Israel with the Israeli women, we always had to keep in mind our Palestinian hostesses over across on the other side of the checkpoints, and when we were in Palestine, and we were asked to give speeches and meet in different places, we always had to be aware of our Israeli colleagues. But I think what was really important was that women were doing all this kind of work. And especially in Palestine, where women often are more kind of home-based, our march enabled all the women to come out and march with us. So I feel like there's an enormous amount of strength, and I think nonviolence in women, and I mean, I hate to, is that a terrible stereotypic thing to say, but one of the expressions of Code Pink is, as a mother, I will not raise my child to kill another mother's child. And I think that's something that us as women and many of us as mothers do have in common, so we can kind of think a little bit differently.
I want to play just a little short bit of videotape that I found of you, Ridgely Fuller, leading a large group of Palestinian kids in dancing the hokey pokey. Now just tell us what was going on in your mind as you were with all of these kids, because it looked like a really joyful occasion.
I had no language to be able to use with them, so I kind of resort to what's most familiar with me. So I've had training in working with children who've had trauma and working with groups of children. Actually, so interesting because the trainers said, you know, you'll do fine, but something will come up. And so doing the hokey pokey, that's what came up. What you didn't see, because it was hard to take pictures, was a lot of yoga. And so I was doing yoga with circles of kids. And it was really interesting being able to kind of model stretches for them. So certainly the laughter was everywhere, you know, and that's certainly something all over the world. And laughter gives you immediate feedback that you know that whatever work you're doing on trauma is being successful because you have people laughing. So that's really good. I felt like the kids, they were incredibly starved for affection and attention. And I think part of that comes from the trauma that a lot of the adults as well as the kids have had, and the families, as I mentioned early on, are taking care of a lot of very injured and traumatized other adults and kids as well. So you have lots of kids who are looking for attention and for nurturing and for positive stuff from adults. So certainly that was an incredible thing. And then the other thing that I was really struck by is that the boys were very dominant. And I guess this is certainly true. I've worked in inner city schools in the United States, too, and so that's also been true. But I didn't have language to be able to try and get them to listen to me. So one of the games that I did, I taught these kids how to do Duck, Duck, Goose. I don't know if you remember Duck, Duck, Goose.
Oh, I remember Duck, Duck, Goose.
Well, that was awesome because the only way to really play Duck, Duck, Goose is to sit in a circle and wait your turn. And you'd have boys who couldn't do that, and they'd be jumping in and out of the circle and running around. When the boys realized that in order to get our kind of attention, they needed to sit in a circle and participate, they really did. And meanwhile, we were modeling for them. So there'd be a lot of times where I would motion to the girls just to say, come on, girls, let's just go. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And we're just not going to be able to let the boys come and play until they learn how to do this with us. So it was pretty funny. But I never thought that I'd be doing Duck, Duck, Goose in Gaza. And the kids would end up talking Duck, Duck, Goose. It was funny. It really was.
You remind me of Jo Wilding. She was in, you know, Iraq and touring Iraq with a circus during these very, very dangerous times there, I might add.
Yeah.
And she would kind of arrive with a big movable feast of a circus and boom shaka, she would shout, and all the kids would come flocking because they had gotten to know what she was doing there.
Yeah.
Kids are kids.
Yeah.
In war or not.
Right.
So talk about your work as a social worker and what it means to you, Ridgely Fuller, that you're able to have these opportunities to meet with these kids whose lives are so damaged.
It's certainly fun for me. I mean, I laugh as much as they do, and so there's an enormous amount of fun and affection, and that's always positive for everybody, whether it's somebody who's had trauma or somebody who hasn't. There's a lot of personal fulfillment in that, too. I mean, clearly, as I was leaving Gaza, there was only one piece of equipment that I brought with me, and I brought four of them. There were these big parachutes. And I had a lot of activities that I would have wanted to do with kids and to train other adults in how to do those kind of activities with kids. There just was not the time or the opportunity to be able to do that. And I knew that the adults really needed to be well-trained in how to do that, because sometimes it is bouncing kids up, and so you don't want it to be dangerous. So by the time when I was leaving, I felt one of my hosts was saying he wanted me to stay for a month because he was running a program this summer for children who've been displaced by war. And I gave him some of the parachutes. I showed him and his family how to use them, and so hopefully they'll would have been able to train a lot of the counselors in their use. And I also ended up meeting some of the UNRWA people at the end, who I wish that I'd had contact with in the beginning, and so being able to kind of work with them. So as a social worker, it's hard just to go in and do something for an hour or two that you know is not going to have any kind of impact at all. I mean, it's much more satisfying to be able to go in and train people to be able to make it an everyday kind of occurrence for the children. So I felt very frustrated as well, you know, in leaving so quickly and not having the chance to do what I would have made much more of an impact.
You can always return, we hope.
Well, we hope, but you never know about the borders. You just don't. It's sheer chance if you can get in. You know, and once, actually, I think a lot of the people on the Gaza boats who went in, some of them stayed, and then the Egyptian government said they weren't going to let them out. It's very much like being in prison. If you're lucky enough to be able to get in, then, you know, we as Americans or as Code Pinkers, we have the luxury of leaving with Code Pink. But you can easily be kept in Gaza and have no control over when you're going to be able to get out. And that's really a sacrifice. People who are willing to do that and give up that kind of control over their life, I think they're just, I mean, those are the true heroes. And there have been a lot of those people who have just not been able to get out when they thought they'd be able to.
And Ridgely Fuller, how is it that you came to be interested in the group Code Pink?
I was pretty actively opposed to our invasion of Iraq, and Code Pink had a march on Washington, and I went and joined in that march, and it was a wonderfully joyous march. We surrounded the White House in pink, and I think that's a part of Kopeng's philosophy is that they're against war, whether it's they want to end wars and prevent new ones from beginning, they want to redirect resources to education and green jobs and health care, but they want this to be done with in a spirit of joy and humor, and that really attracts me. I feel like, you know, it's so easy to get so disheartened and bogged down because of the real serious work that we're all doing. So that joyfulness, I really think, is important. And actually, after that, I came back to Boston. We organized the Code Pink kind of event at Park Street Station here. One, it was April Fool's Morning, where we were all dressed, all these women in pink bathrobes with their hair in rollers. Bush was president then, and we had pink towels, and we were all singing, "We're going to wash that man right out of our hair." And people would laugh, and it was a nice way to start the day, you know. So I think there are a lot of ways you can deliver a message for peace and justice, and to be able to deliver that message with some humor, I feel like it's really important. It's real hard, but it's important to do that.
And I guess you haven't put your rollers away during the time Michelle Obama and Barack Obama are in the White House.
No, no, but I haven't been. Hopefully I'll go down and be more with Code Pink, but I'm extremely concerned about, you know, what's going on in Afghanistan, and you know, of course, many of us disheartened about the whole issue of our health care and the policies that hopefully will certainly have a public option. I believe this Progressive Caucus and the House, they're the ones I'm pinning my hopes on. I think it's important to keep trying to be joyful and positive. It's really important, yeah.
Ridgely Fuller, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, and I look forward to being in Connecticut.
And we'll link to the video on YouTube of Ridgely Fuller leading Palestinian kids in dancing the hokey pokey. Ridgely Fuller will be speaking in Connecticut September 14th at the First Church of Christ in Mansfield. It's at 7 p.m. The event is sponsored by the Israel-Palestine Peace Education and Action Group of Eastern Connecticut. Ridgely Fuller is a social worker and Code Pink member from the Boston area on a speaking tour discussing her trips to Palestine, the latest one in June of 2009. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. One more announcement as to upcoming events. Dar Jamail is coming this September, too. On September 20th at 7 p.m., in fact, he will visit the University of Connecticut in Storrs in an event sponsored by WHUS Radio, the campus station at FM 91.7. For a full listing of events, go to willtoresistwar.blogspot.com. I'm Dori Smith. Our website, talknationradio.org. You'll find a list of other stations airing this show, syndicated with Pacifica Network. Our music is by Fritz Heed. FritzHeed.com. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com.
And that's the first segment of This Week in Palestine, a major part of Truth and Justice Radio. Really, a treasured part of Truth and Justice Radio. This is Stan Robinson, and I'm subbing for Sharif Fahm this week. Sharif is taking a well-deserved week off, and we must wish him the best. What he does is an absolute treasure, and we need to support him, and we need to get on the bandwagon and do something about the problems that we are learning about. Now we have something special. We have a live interview coming up with Ray Davies and Wendy Lewis. Are you there?
Yes, we are.
Yes, we both are, yes.
Okay. Now, I've been told that you two have been doing something very significant for the benefit of Palestine's population in recent times. Would you be willing to outline that for us?
Yes, we were first invited over to the West Bank by the British Council to do a cultural tour with our small Welsh choir. And we went out there, and we hadn't been out there just a few minutes. We'd gone through two checkpoints, and we realized what Palestinians were going through every day. You could more or less touch the oppression that was there. But we had a brilliant tour. We went to Nablus, Bethlehem, Ramallah, and we went into Israel as well. And wherever we went, people were absolutely tremendous. They were so generous. They shook our hands. And what was most important, they thanked us for just coming there, and same for ourselves, what was happening to this small enclave, this occupied territory. And whilst we were there, we met. We went into Gaza, which was probably the worst of all. It was a dirty, terrible place to be in. Children were running in the streets. But when you go into the houses, they're spotlessly clean. And even though the people have got nothing, they share that nothing with you. Wendy and myself, would you like to tell them, Wendy, about our visit with Mona El-Farah and the small clinic?
Yes. This was in 1994 for the first time we went to see her. And she was running a small clinic in Gaza, which was had very few supplies and so on. We went to visit the Daesh refugee camp. We met an old woman whose son had been one of the first people, were first casualties in the latest intifada, and she grabbed her hand and she said, "Don't come here and just look and go away again. I don't want that. If you come and see us, talk to us, find out what's happening, and go out and tell the world what you see." So that's what the choir determined to do after we'd been to see all the suffering. And when we came back to Cardiff, we, every week since 1994, we've sung in the streets, collected money, leafleted for a whole range of peace groups within Israel and Palestine, Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions and Women for Peace and the International Solidarity Movement and various grassroots groups and rehabilitation centers in Bethlehem to raise money. And the public response has changed dramatically since when we first began, when we got some abuse and resistance, and now people have become more and more generous.
The important thing, I think, we met some people while we had this wonderful visit, and we have met some marvelous people since we've been in the Boston area. Our message to the ordinary people is to don't worry when you go out in the street. Yes, you will have a little bit of abuse to start off with, but you will be surprised because there's a wealth of support for the Palestinian people out in the streets of America, out in the streets of Boston. And like everything else, there's a small vocal minority who was against it. And then there's a large middle swathe who just don't know, who's so confused. But there's a pocket of people there where they support, and they look for that support. And you'd be surprised when people come up to you on the street and shake your hand and thank you profusely, sometimes with tears in their eyes, and put $50 into the bucket and thank you and thank us just for being there.
Are these the people who are coming to enjoy your choral performances in Wales?
No, not necessarily. Of course, everybody in Wales loves singing. You know, it goes without saying. But when you stand on the street, on many streets of Cardiff, you've got buskers, etc. But we use our voice as a campaigning tool as well. And as they hear the songs, the Palestinian songs, all over the world, they start looking at the placards and they come over and they take a leaflet and they go away and then they come back after reading the leaflet, money in the bucket, because once they put that few coppers in or that pounds or that $50 in, they then committed to the struggle for peace and freedom, for security for Israel and an independent state for Palestine. That's what they commit themselves to when they put a few coppers in the bucket. But it's just the same when someone take a leaflet, you don't have to collect money. In some places, it's illegal to collect money. But just being there, just having those leaflets there, just using your voice as a tool to attract attention, it's a wonderful mixture and an essential tool in the campaign.
And I found that it's been a real ripple effect. We started out, and there wasn't anyone else doing it. And then other choirs took some of our songs. And then soon there were groups all over the place. And now there's many, many people who have been out and experienced it and are spreading the message further about the truth about what's going on. And the internet is helping and emails, so that the information is getting through.
Yeah, the other thing we try to do, Stan, is encourage people to go over there and see for themselves. Because if you start inquiring, there are many ways you can visit the occupied territories in complete safety in many instances. You can help with the olive harvest. The olive harvest is so important to the Palestinian people. And once you are there, once internationals are there, the settlers and the soldiers will protect you. Everybody will protect you. And they can have harvest because that's the lifeblood of the Palestinian people. You can go there on a cultural tour, because when you go on a cultural tour, you've got to go through checkpoint after checkpoint after checkpoint, which is perfectly safe, but you can sense and the oppression which is there as you're going through the checkpoints.
Of course. I should explain to listeners something that I didn't already, and that is that Ray Davies and Wendy Lewis are part of a musical group which performs. They have a website. Let's see if I can find it. www.corcochion.org.uk. I'll spell out that corcochion. CORCOCHION. So www.corcochion.org.uk. And it gives pictures of this choral group. And we actually have a musical clip from them, which I should probably go ahead and give you just a few seconds of anyway. I understand it is the name of the tune is Yama. It is a Palestinian mother's lament. I would rather walk on a path of daggers than endure the suffering of this occupation. Let me go ahead and play a few bars of this.
ABS Media Demo. AVS Media Demo.
This group that you lead, you sing a cappella
right on the
streets.
Yes. So we've become quite a tradition in Cardiff now, and we have our little spot opposite the market, and come rain or shine, winter or summer, we're always out there. In fact, sometimes, when the weather is bad, people give us money because it looks so ridiculously outrageous that we're out there, and this rain is pouring down, we've got our umbrellas, and we're singing there with our buckets, and people smile as they pass. Sometimes, they think, what are these, who are these nuts? But they enjoy the music, and they put the money in. And some, we have raised, on occasion, many hundreds of pounds, but generally we do very well every week to raise the money.
Yeah, and I think for the people, Stan, it illustrates our commitment. And we have got a very, very strong commitment, because most of the choir have been out there and have seen it. And I should be going back out now later this year, back out onto the occupied territories, and I will be helping with the olive harvest, and I will be standing helping the people through the checkpoints to go to hospital. I'll be going out into the sticks and helping repairing the water pipes, which sometimes the rednecks rip apart. And there is so much of the things we'll be doing out there. I'll also be giving out the money to the orphanages, to the small children's hospitals, to the women's groups, to all these people who desperately need the money and need the support. The money's important to them, but the support is there. And I come back, my batteries are fully charged, and I'll do absolutely anything at all within my grasp to help these fantastic people who have suffered so much for some 50, 60 years.
But then Ray's unusually, I think he's fearless, and he has been out for a number of different groups, and on occasion when he's had to, he really is pushed the, you know, pushed it out as far as he could go, and sort of defended the children who were trying to cross the road. And of course, in the past, we've had Rachel Corey and other people who've been shot trying to do that, and that's what happened to Ray as well on occasion.
Oh, that's right. I understand you were shot in the head, as well as deported by the occupiers. Israel.
Yes, yes. Mm. Yeah, I'm always angry because I know that the bulk of American and British people and free people believe in the Geneva Convention, and when I see things happening to the Palestinians, I go straight up to the soldiers and quote the Geneva Convention to them and tell them that they've got to allow the injured Palestinians who've been injured in the raid free access to hospital, free access to medical treatment, and I've done it so many times, and I always wear my red hat so they know I'm an international. So one day I did get shot there. But one thing that I really that did me a power of good, Stan, I was walking through the Balata refugee camp when every 3 or 4 hours you hear an armoured car and you hear shots taking place. And as I used to walk through there escorting the children, I looked up at a window, and there was a little boy who used to wave at me every morning. And when I came back one day, I knocked the door, I went up. I said, why isn't this little boy in school with the rest? And her mom said, he's deaf. He can't hear. I can't allow my precious baby out in those streets. He can't hear the bullets. He can't hear the hear the guns. And so I was able to, with the help of some fantastic people, to bring him back to Britain and to give him a proper a test, and they give him a fantastic hearing aid, and he went back to, and he was allowed to play in the streets, and he's now doing fantastically well educationally. You know, so there's these things that people can do if they go out there, and my appeal is for people, the American people's men, go out in the streets, do the campaigning, and if you can, try and organize trips. There are many people in Boston who can help you to get out there and see for yourselves and be part of a campaign which will save the world, I think.
It's very touching what your experience is, and I hope this encourages listeners to follow suit. Our normal host always urges listeners to actually visit Palestine, and I am now hearing this echoed. I haven't been there myself. He has, and so I really appreciate what you're doing. Let me ask you a final question that we haven't been able to get to yet. Are you able to actually get money or supplies into Gaza?
Yes.
And if it's money, does it get translated into supplies or support once it gets in?
That's right. Well, the doctor we mentioned works with Barbara Lubin with the Middle East Children's Alliance, MECA.
The doctor is Mona
El-Farah. Right. And she runs the Gaza hospital that we support. And on the website, there's a direct link, a donation link, and an update. She went in the latest convoy to bring supplies through Gaza, and they will they raise the money on the internet, so our donations go directly online to them. They then will buy the materials in perhaps Egypt, Jordan, wherever, come to the border and wait for the gates to to be opened, and they have all got through. So it is a very secure way of donating, because we know that money's got there, and we've had the feedback from her.
And more important, we always get a receipt, because people sometimes challenge you, what have happened to the money? There's no middle person there at all. It goes straight there. The money that you collect or you donate will transform itself immediately into badly needed medical equipment, drugs, etc. And you get a receipt back of the money, and it is the very best way to get help to the Palestinian people.
So it's www.mecca4peace, M-E-C-A for peace.
Is that a numeral for?
No, MECAFORPEACE.org.
Okay. Is there a UK at the end of that?
No, it's a, it's. She's actually, Barbara Lubin is actually based in New York.
Okay. MECAFORPEACE.org. I think we need to actually add that to our website, which is truthandjusticeradio.org.
Yeah.
And is there a way to hear some of your music by going on to that Korkochian?
Korkochian.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether the link is set up yet, but
I think what would be a good idea, I think, Stan, if at some time during the day you could give us your the address and we could send our Palestinian tape or DVD to you. And this tape was made in the occupied territories with the help of the Palestinian musical groups out there. And we could do that, and we could send it to you, and we would be grateful, because if it can help in any way, we would be so pleased.
That is most gallant, and I will accept your offer. I will call you after we get offline here and give you the address.
But the choir also supports a wide range of progressive causes, from all the peace causes, Cuba, Nicaragua. We were actually began in at the time of the miners' strike, but for the Chilean democracy movement, and so we have a wide range of songs which we sing, and every week we sing for a different group. But as I say, Palestine at least once a month, and then on every Tuesday we also sing for Palestine, and the range of Israeli and Palestinian groups. So we cover. People come up to us and say, "Well, what are you doing about so and so?" And I say, "Well, one step at a time." As a matter of fact, that's what happened last week when we were singing for Palestine, and a man who looked a little hostile came up and said, "Well, what are you? Why are you always bothering about Palestine? What about Burma?" And I said, "Well, actually, we sang for Burma last month, so we had that answer for him." Because I think wherever people struggle, there is my native land, is absolutely true. No one can be free until everyone is free, and I think we all believe that. You can't pick and choose your freedoms, can you?
No, and of course we are beginning to have that problem in the United States also, although it hasn't reached the point of having to go under guns every day yet.
And yeah.
Anyway, it's a great pleasure to have you on the air, and we really appreciate what you're doing very, very much.
Thank you, Stan, for having us. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's been the cream on the cake as far as our visit was concerned, that we've been able to meet so many fantastic people and been able to speak to many others on your show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye.
Goodbye.
And that is all we have for today. We wish our listeners a pleasant and restful weekend and look forward to having you with us next week, same time. Until then, this is Sharif Fahm signing off for now and reminding our listeners to get involved. Get involved.